Welcome to the Sacramentalists, a podcast where the ancient Christian faith is brought to bear on issues prevalent in modern culture. And I'm your host for today, Father Wesley Walker. Sadly, Father Creighton can't join us today, but we are joined by two very special guests, Bishop Stephen Scarlett and Father Hayden Butler, both out of St. Matthew's in Newport Beach. How are you all doing?
We're doing well.
Yeah, doing great. Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have both of you. Bishop Scarlett, you are now a recurring guest, so we have to do what they do on Saturday Night Live and get you a jacket to mark the occasion. But Father Hayden, this is your first time on the show. Could you just tell everyone maybe a little bit about yourself, your background, how you came to be where you are?
Sure. I'm the Associate Rector of St. Matthew's Church. I've been on the pastoral staff here for about 8 years. For a lot of that time, I was a bivocational minister. I was also teaching full-time high school literature and theology, and spent the last 7 of those years co-founding a Christian liberal arts school in Newport Beach called Pacifica Christian High School. And then this last year, retired from that to be in full-time parish ministry.
Yes, it's always a fun transition to go from being a teacher to being a full-time minister. In some ways less stressful, in other ways way more stressful.
Yep. That's exactly right.
Nice that you get to have a little more flexibility schedule-wise, but man, it's not easy. Neither one is easy. Well, 2 weeks ago, we were all together in Dallas, Texas, along with a number of other priests and interested people for a retreat. So Bishop Scarlett, could you tell us a little bit about the nature of that retreat and sort of how it came to be?
Yeah, the theme of the retreat was an approach to mission based on a theology of the remnant. And this is something that, you know, I've been interested in mission for the better part of a generation now in this movement, 40 years. And I think I've as the thinking about it has developed, I've sort of realized what is sort of authentic mission and what sometimes are sort of cultural approaches that get branded as mission but really diverge from maybe a more biblical approach. And my own development in this kind of brought me was influenced heavily by Martin Thornton and his thinking in a book called Pastoral Theology Reorientation, which was originally entitled The Remnant, The Heart of the Parish. But it wasn't just, you know, taking what Thornton has to say and, you know, reproducing it, because Thornton was a priest in 20th century England with, you know, established rural parishes. And we're in a, you know, 21st century America, which is really a mission field. So my own thought of this is develop this idea of how does this then translate into mission. And I think the remnant approach to mission is rooted in the link between our own interior spiritual life and our mission to others, that it's rooted in the assumption that we must first be formed as Christians individually, and then as Christians together in community, and have that life of Christ be developed and growing in us before we have anything to share with others. And thus, the remnant approach says that mission begins with the interior formation of the mission of the church. And it begins, therefore, with a priest who calls people to follow him into a pathway of greater spiritual formation, a deeper life of prayer, a deeper commitment. And this contrasts with the prevailing approach in our culture, which is often rooted in a more sales and marketing, you know, modality, where we as a church decide how are we going to get people to come, and we try to make it attractive for people to come. But often this approach doesn't ask, what are we offering to people when they come? And too often, in my observation and experience, what it overlooks often is the truth that the community that is trying to ask people to come is unaware of its own emotional and spiritual immaturity, and therefore it is not really prepared to share Christ with others. It ends up more sort of wanting to, you know, sustain its franchise or have people come and do what they're doing, but it doesn't really deal more deeply with how is the life of Christ being lived out in community, how are we growing in it, and how you want to share this with others. And so it seems like there's two essential errors, you know, in mission. One is you have this or lack of mission. It is you have an excessively interior focus. Our church is concerned about us. We might have all kinds of spiritual programs and retreats where we're growing, but we don't really think too much about anybody who's not us. And then on the other extreme, you have the approach where church is really concerned with how to get people to come, how we make things attractive, but it isn't very concerned about its own interior life. So the balance is the cultivation of the interior life of individuals in community, which then naturally leads to an outward orientation. And I think this follows on the theology of the Trinity, that the mission of God, both in creating the world and then in sending his son to save it, is rooted in the fullness of Trinitarian love, that God is so full of love that his experience within himself naturally spills outward into sharing it with others. And I think a church that begins to cultivate its life in Christ and participates in Trinitarian love and the Spirit will naturally flow out into mission. And to the extent that either the interior activity of the Spirit or the outward, you know, movement is lacking, there's something defective, therefore, in the life of the church. And so, and just to one last point about this is that, so we sort of began this as St. Matthew's Church, a purposeful reorientation centered on a program we developed called the Pastoral Ministry Program, started about 8 years ago. And it's, you know, substantially transformed the way we approach mission and ministry and had a, you know, significant impact. It's now migrated out into a program of the Diocese of the Holy Trinity, which you're now approaching ministry through this lens. And so the mission retreat was a desire to share that with a larger group across the church who's interested in participating in that conversation.
Yeah, that was it was really great. I think it was really helpful to have some of those conversations face to face because, you know, you can read Thornton. You can listen to some of the things that you've said here and elsewhere, but actually being able to have interaction and back and forth was really helpful. One thing that you talked about, I think it was in one of your first talks, was the need for missionaries, specifically missionary priests. And you mentioned we're in a very different context than Martin Thornton was when he wrote about remnant theology. What does it mean then for us to be missionary priests in our modern context? What's required of us?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good question because I think as Anglicans, especially Anglo-Catholics, have often inherited a little bit of an institutional psychology that, you know, we come from this structure and we get bishops and priests and deacons, and so we have a parish and someone gets ordained to become a rector of a parish, and that presupposes a given group of people they'll minister to. And I think it's obscured the reality of our setting, that we are in a mission setting, both in terms of the Anglican tradition, which is decayed because of some of the theological liberalism and the decay of the spiritual life. And also just because culturally, you know, people aren't shopping for churches anymore. You know, even our movement started, a church could go to an area and decide, okay, we're the such and such church. You could advertise, you know, I'm old enough to remember when that was print advertising, but even now with internet and other modalities, you know, it presumes that you'd say, oh, hey, we're this kind of church, we do this kind of thing, and some people be looking for that kind of thing. But now we're in a setting where, well, they aren't really looking for that kind of thing. People are looking for things. They just aren't looking for those categories of things. So a missionary priest, therefore must be someone who more fundamentally has had a, you know, an experience in his own life of conversion to faith in Christ, who cultivates his own life in this remnant model for the life for prayer, and desires to share that with others. And I think one of the key things, it's a kind of vocational sense, a calling to be present for others and to reach out beyond one's border. And that would be contrasted, I think, with the idea of a priest as all be ordained, all go become rector of a parish, and here I'll just take care of my people. Now, you'll do that. I don't want to minimize that because the way you would take care of your people, I think, in a missionary remnant framework is, first of all, you begin to form them and call them to more and develop a community that can then be present for the people around. So I think it's that vocational sense, and then looking not just to say sell the distinctives of this tradition, which are important. I'm not minimizing that, but in a missionary sense, you want to say, well, who am I reaching out to, and where the people reaching out to, how can we offer Christ to them in a way that they can experience him? And that's often more about first dealing with where people are in terms of their lives, their pains, their traumas, their experiences, and then developing relationships, and then explaining why the tradition ministers to that in a deep way, the sacraments, the life of prayer, all these kinds of things. But at root, a missionary priest has a vocation to reach out beyond himself, must be more like St. Paul than the typical, you know, Anglican rector of a couple centuries ago.
I think it was helpful too at the conference you talked about how this is kind of an invitation through relationship rather than I think what I've experienced, and I grew up evangelical, was often that we would do outreach through program. You know, we have Awanas, so bring your kids to Awanas, or we have X, Y, or Z, you know, whatever program, and we need to offer the programs people are the most interested in. But this is radically different than that.
Yes, it's very much relational in the sense. I mean, I remember from my own experience. You know, I went through my family was Episcopalian, and you know, I was nominally raised in that, but I didn't pay much attention to it, and went through a kind of conversion in my college years, and I decided, well, I should probably go back to church. So I went to the church my family was going to, St. Peter's in Oakland at that point in time, where the rector was one of the founding bishops of our movement, Bishop Morse. And, you know, the first time I went back to church, you know, went to church, I'm walking out on Sunday, the greeting line, Bishop Morse, who always, he was one of these people who took interest outside. Hey, Steve, hi, what are you doing Saturday? I don't know. He said, well, I want you to come to lunch with me and this friend of mine, invite me out to lunch, and started finding out, you know, and so it drew me into relationship with them, and I got drawn into this thing. And then, you know, so I think this is the relational side, is we have to take an interest in people as people before we start selling them in terms of what we're doing. And I think so it's an individual call. Who are you? And I think the psychology of this is that when we take a real interest in people, not just because we want them to fill out a pledge card, not just because we need more money to save the church, but because we have something we see, hey, I think, and we want to know who they are, what their story is, and we begin to have a conversation, we also give the impression, we also make the statement that this church, whatever this church is doing, produces a spirit that is interested in people. Whereas often, you know, the church is like, okay, well, here's what we do, and here, let me show you how to read the bulletin and all that, which is all stuff that's needed, but that's really not what people are looking for when they show up.
You sort of alluded to this a little bit, but what unique difficulties do we face moving forward, specifically as Anglicans, as Anglo-Catholics, as continuing Anglicans, in terms of realizing this vision of mission through remnant.
Yeah. No, I think there's some significant things there. One thing I realized, you know, coming into this movement as someone who had gone through a conversion and then came into it and was told to do these things, I found them very life-changing and forming, that I didn't go through the beginning of our movement when there was this separation from the Episcopal tradition, which had become, you know, quite frankly, heretical. And so our founding movement had a psychology of, you know, Anglo-Catholics were a besieged minority in the Episcopal Church. And they had developed a psychology of holding on against the onslaught of these things. And when they came out of that and began to move forward, they held on to that sort of more holding that more besieged mentality. They didn't really know how to translate that into mission. So I think one of the challenges we have is, first of all, change that psychology to grow beyond that and to draw on the larger Anglican, Anglo-Catholic tradition of profound missionary priests, you know, who went into vineyard cities and did missionary work, and the profound energy of the Church of England historically to go overseas and start things. And so that's one thing. The other, another thing that's significant is that the way we think of ministry and priesthood, sometimes in our culture, especially in a therapeutic culture, we're thinking about helping people, comforting people, and there's a psychology in parish ministry often, or how do we not rock the boat? How do we make things nice? And I think that the missionary priest who really wants to help people has to move from just making it nice to being a challenger, to challenging people to do new things and to move in new directions. And then the secondary thing, when you begin to challenge people, which promotes change, what we've learned through various resources we lean on is that when you challenge things to change, you'll encounter what is called sabotage. People won't like it and they'll push back. And so if you really want to change a church culture, you have to persevere in the work that you're doing through the opposition, and the result will be real change. And that's the thing, because a lot of people just hope that they see the kind of challenge around them and they want to just return it back to the status quo, the equilibrium, and you have to be willing to change to push through that. So we have to change what we think about ourselves, be a little bit more, you know, I don't know, biblically a little more Jeremiah than just than just, you know, making things nice all the time. Now, I want to be clear. This sounds a little, you know, the balance here is that you're challenging people to grow, and this is your love for them because you see that they're not okay. So when Jesus says, repent for the kingdom of heaven is at hand, he didn't come to say, hey, there, it's fine, because it wasn't fine. It needed to change. But so the challenge comes out of love, and we have to be careful because clearly, you know, sometimes, you know, there can be amongst people who are more traditional, a streak of anger or something that become that, and that doesn't really compel people to come. So a balance of challenge in love, speaking the truth in love, calling people to more. And I think this actually meets a need, because I think in our culture, people aren't looking to go to church, but people do want to connect with people, do want to connect with God, and are willing to give more often than we ask of them. And I think that's one of the things that we become a church. We call people to a higher way of life and provide a way for them to enter into it. I think that can be attractive in the best sense of the word. So
I've been reading The Consolation of Philosophy with some friends, and there's this part, for those who may not be familiar with it, Boethius is about to be put to death, and he had formerly been very successful, and he's kind of blaming fortune for all of his problems. But Lady Philosophy says it doesn't really matter what fortune brings you or takes away, because if you live by fortune, you die by fortune, and there's no, the only thing about fortune that's constant is that she's always changing. But what you can affect is your pursuit of wisdom, and that no one can take away from you. But if you really pursue wisdom, then people will resist that, And that seems like that's true even in a parish. It shouldn't be true in a parish, but it often is true, especially I think in our context. Yes, it's certainly a degree of fortitude has to be developed in order to do this well.
It makes me smile because you mentioned St. Boethius, that's we have a budding Colorado mission community. One of the names on the table for the St. Boethius mission community, because one of its founding members is very fond of that particular writing and what it has to say. So, yeah.
It strikes me though that, you know, you also in the consolation, you can also have bad fortune even while you're pursuing wisdom. And that, I think that also calls us into it calls us into a different kind of relationship with apparent success with our parishes. I came up, you know, as a hybrid of a formation between the Methodism and Evangelicalism. And in either of those worlds, you have Methodism, which was by and large dying in my part of the country. And, you know, there's this, you know, robust spirituality, but didn't have a lot of people in the pews. And then you had over in the evangelical church, you know, at times those two things lined up. You had a lot of people in the seats and a really robust, you know, kind of biblical based teaching. And at times you had a lot of people in the seats and there wasn't much of substance being preached from the pulpit. And I think, you know, one of the great gifts of Boethius's writing is sometimes your apparent success is not an indication that you're doing the right thing. And your apparent, you know, failure isn't an indication necessarily you're doing the wrong thing. I think that's helpful as a paradigm.
Well, it seems like too, right there, that it ties on to this idea of vocation. So mm-hmm. a vocation to pursue wisdom as regards to, you know, the knowledge of God and how we reach people. And you pursue that no matter what obstacles, because that's the goal, not simply to make things nicer, bigger, or happier.
And that's one of the things Lady Philosophy says to him at the beginning, you know, you've lost yourself. Because you're tying your end to whatever kind of thing fortune delivers to you, but that's just not how we actually live an integrated life. Now, Father Hayden, you gave a great presentation, and it was a joint presentation with a few other people, but specifically on the topic of mission in youth ministry. And you had some really helpful insights into the unique challenges of reaching adolescents in the modern world. And I think anybody who's worked in parish ministry for any extended period of time realizes that this is a really difficult demographic to reach. Why is that so challenging to reach adolescents?
I think one, we're not really sure anymore what adolescents really are. This is a point that I think Father Mark Perkins started to point out really well in his drawing on some work that's been done in the last couple of decades. A book that comes to mind that's kind of a seminal work in this thread is Robert Epstein's book Teen 2.0, which is this, you know, gargantuan tome that tracks the history of the development of what we think adolescence is now, particularly in the idea of the teenager. So this is tracking the ages roughly from 13 to 19, and pointing out that largely it's an artificial construct. It doesn't really necessarily exist, but in the way we emphatically insist that it exists. And, you know, his work goes into a lot of the taproots of that, how it kind of began as the kind of creation of a protected group of early adulthood to help kids not get exploited by rightly exploitative, kind of industrial practices. But then became as cultural value shifted, became ultimately what we see it as it is now. It evolved over a century to be this thing where we have an artificially extended childhood, where we give very little meaningful responsibility to a group of people, and yet also allocate a tremendous amount of spending power to them, either directly or via their parents. And so a lot of money is being made off of this group that doesn't have a lot of real responsibility. And so not a lot of incentive to have a lot of long-term thinking when it comes to investment or anything like that. And so, and that number and that adolescence just kind of gets pushed forward and forward and forward. I think now, sociologically speaking, it's somewhere like adolescence is extended somewhere like 25, 27 years old. It's become kind of ridiculous, but it's technically defined that way now. So, yeah, I think that's our first challenge: is what is this person? What are they? I think anciently, And really, even still in most cultures, you don't really have this category exist very much, except insofar as they've imbibed this kind of developed Western kind of idea that's been created and is relatively new. You know, across the span of humanity, you kind of had childhood, and then childhood came to a definitive end through some sort of rite of passage, and then you were welcomed into an immature but nevertheless, you know, imparted adulthood, and then expected to grow into the adulthood of your tribe, of your people, and to become a full-fledged member of one of the people. It was childhood, then adulthood. And you might be lame and incompetent at your adulthood at first, and we could account for that. But the goal was nevertheless to get you through that incompetency as efficiently as possible so that you could participate in the adult life of your people. And I think in somewhere along the way, we lost a sense of that, not only in kind of a broader sense of culture, but also the church, I think, has imbibed it in its own way.
Yeah, Thornton talks about when you're a regular, how you might be a bad regular, but you're still a regular. And that helps because, you know, if you, I think the example he uses in Christian Proficiency is, you know, if I say I'm going to give up smoking during Lent, and then I have a cigarette the first day of Lent, I could just give up, or I could say, well, I didn't meet my goal, but I'm going to keep trying. So right. if you consider a young person an adult, they might be a bad adult, but it at least gives you that category and those expectations, and you can kind of shepherd them into that. But if they're in a totally separate group, then right. Yeah, I mean, you can't impose those standards onto them.
No, and it seems like sacramentally too, we don't really have a category for the modern notion of a teenager, right? Sacramentally speaking, we have baptism, you know, which is, you know, imparts the life of Christ within us. We have confirmation, right? The empowering of the Holy Ghost to exercise our mission as Christians. We have the Eucharist, right? These rites of initiation. There's not really a sort of like, well, we're going to give you the sacramental gift, but it's kind of a provisional sort of a probationary period with it. It's like, no, like you have hands laid on you. You have, you know, you are sealed for this thing. And it doesn't admit of that kind of adulthood, which I think, you know, historically is why you kind of see a very different attitude among people, you know, of that adolescent age group. I remember reading Eusebius in my undergraduate years, and reading the history of the early church, and seeing like there's like these like 13-year-olds that are like, "Yep, time to go get martyred." You know, Christ is my only passion in life, and they go run off to, you know, and their parents are like, "Hold on there, you know, Johnny, you know, you got to kind of get reined in a little bit here." And
Origen's mother had to hide his clothes so he wouldn't
right, go exactly.
get martyred with his father. Right,
yeah, exactly. People are you know these otherwise these teens. And but you know what? I worked nearly 20 years with young people of that age, you know, between the ages of probably 11 and 20. And that's kind of how they are. I think what they need is training and proficiency, as Thornton would say it, or being a good regular, because they've definitely got like the zeal for it if it can be directed. I think, though, another challenge that we're facing, though, is that what's developed around them now and is more accessible than ever is really a multi-billion dollar industry that is geared towards keeping them as impulsive as possible. And so that definitely stands directly antithetically to what we're about, I think, as Christians of an ancient faith, right? That is, we're not people who are, again, we're Boethius people, you know, at our best moment. We're not people who are looking at the short-term gain. We're looking at people, we're looking at things that stand the test of centuries. As traditionalists. And so I think one of the challenges of presenting youth with a traditional vision of faith is that not only are they being inundated with a lot of well-created, targeted temptations, really, to be as impulsive as they can be and to spend as much money on those impulses as is possible. And then also, which has also been adapted by the church in its own way, who is trying to do, I've seen kind of try to do a kind of, you know, bidding war with the culture and trying to, you know, present its own vision of that, that impulse and enthusiasm driven, way of life, coded within kind of Christian, you know, living generally, but ultimately is going to lose to that secular vision of it. And because it can't throw a party that, you know, is more, you know, intense than someone else is willing to throw because that has no ethics around it, and is just looking to kind of draw them in. So the church can't you know, can't be in this arms race with an enthusiasm and impulse based culture. It will lose that fight. But that was never really, to assent to that as being the fight already sort of tacitly affirms that that's a real thing, when I think we may need to take a step back and say, maybe we agreed to a contest here on terms that we should never have assented to in the first place.
Yeah, I think you're spot on in all of that analysis. The tricky part is knowing that these are our challenges. How then should we live? And I know, I mean, some of this is we develop robust kind of infrastructure within the parish where, you know, you have a young family that has young kids and you can kind of walk through them as the child gets older and shepherd them through some of these difficult channels. There is an aspect that makes it hard. And I'm just speaking from my own context where, you know, sometimes you get a family and they've got teenagers who are already in the thick of this. So it's like, I haven't had, you know, 6 years to form and shape them. And all of a sudden they're with their smartphones and, you know, in a public school and all those kind of things. So what does that really look like for us then to reorient our youth ministries at the parish level, knowing that this is kind of what we're up against?
Part of it, I think, is not giving into the desperation mindset. You know, I've been around a lot of programs geared towards the formation of youth that kind of jump on board this idea that these are the critical years, you know, and the critical years are always sort of shifting here and there, right? You know, sometimes it's high school, sometimes it was college 20 years ago, now it's, you know, maybe younger. It's difficult to say, right? There's not really anything concrete behind that, but I think one of the things is we have to do what we can with the time we have, and make an impression of a plausible Christian adulthood, however long we have them, for however whatever age we have them, and make it memorable as we can, that presence, because that's the thing that when enthusiasm has its natural ebbs and flows, which we can't always control when we're getting them on which side of that arc. We want to be the memorable Christian adult, the mature, proficient Christian adult that they can be. I like, well, you know, I did meet that one priest or that one lay person that one time, and that has stuck with me over the years. Because I think, you know, we make a lot of like, oh, these are the best years of your life, and then the college is the best years of your life. Like, God forbid, you know, but then everyone goes through that period of intense ennui, or like in their early 20s, that, you know, then they're reevaluating all this stuff, and it's like, that might actually be a season of opportunity, but if we kowtow to desperation when they're younger and we act all anxious and needy to get their approval and their attention and their immediate assent, then we're just going to be the memorable presence of a needy Christian in their history rather than someone who said, I may only have you for today, but if that's the case, I'm going to be as plausible and as present to you as a Christian as I can be. And so what that throws on us is the onus is on the rest of the parish, really. And this is what I think, you know, Father Mark Perkins and Rachel Cruz, who were co-presenting with me, what they really drew out as well was, you know, if we want to do youth formation, we have to have adults that youth can grow to be like. You know, what I talked about in my presentation was, you know, forming the moral imagination of the parish around, and specific to youth is, you know, there needs to be a vision of adulthood that their heart wants to own and that their reason will, as it develops, come to ratify. But, you know, that we all want a hero. We all want the call of the mentor. And so I think, you know, hand in hand with youth formation is not hyper-isolating youth. It's to say, do we have adults in our parish who are the kind of people we would want youth to grow up to be like? Or are they kind of acting as impulsively and as anxiously and as, you know, and driven by their own kind of enthusiasm culture as our youth are? And have they grown out of that? And then, so those two things, I think those conversations have to go hand in hand. And I might even privilege the adult one before and say, you know, do we have adults, you know, like actual Christian adults? And then if we do, then we can help them start to be like that. Bishop,
I was going to say that. I mean, so Thornton somewhere talks about the saying that the spiritual maturity of the average adult Christian is something like that of a small child. So you it really is this sort of moving away from consumer marketing approach we're talking about for the Remnant General, is, you see how it ties into the kids. The kids are just younger in this thing, but we adults are still in the same thing. You know, you don't have a different dynamic. And the thing that came up to me, I think, was as Father Hayden was talking, is simply this relational idea that whereas even with adult ministry, we want to take an interest in people, I think the same thing, rather than getting huge groups of kids to get excited about a program, be better, hey, what's your name? And get to know you as an individual and find out who they really are, what they really desire. And then out of that relationship space, they could challenge to live in a way that's better, you know, can be developed. So.
There's sort of a paradox here, I think, in a sense where when people might see our churches and they don't have a ton that's directly marketed towards youth by way of programs, they might think, well, we're not very interested in that age group. But what we're proposing here, at least, is we want to treat them as fully human, and we want to see them and we want to get to know them and build those relationships. And in some ways a tough sell, but I think Father Hayden, I think you're exactly right about all of this. It's very important that we do this and that we do this well.
I think we have to meet with some of the terms that are understood of the people, right? You know, in the terms, we could say we have youth ministry here. You know, at St. Matthew's, we say we have youth ministry. And when you get a little closer, we'll tell you what that youth ministry is like. But you know, we're going to do the thing. We can call it youth ministry. It's not going to look like youth ministry in some places, but we're a church that doesn't look like, you know, how ministry is done or how church or how liturgy is done in some places. So, you know, it's part of that that enculturation, I think, that people, you know, have to come into when they join any new church. So it's difficult in the sense that, you know, it isn't playing on current cultural tropes, and so that there is a translation process that comes into it. But I think the way you expressed it about like treating them as fully human is right. I think, you know, a good friend of mine, Deacon Tim Schmidt, he used to say, you know, what you convert them with, you convert them to. And so if you convert them through a kind of constrained humanity, to use that phrase from Edmund Burke, right, a constrained humanity and a constrained vision of their humanity, we can't expect them to really grow out of it later on, right? If we say, you know, we're gonna recruit you by telling you you're this kind of thing, whether explicitly or implicitly, and saying you're a bundle of impulses that if we just create the right kind of party for, we can play on to try and get you on the inside of this thing. We can't really expect them to like want more than that. If that was how we presented it to them in the first place, it would be very difficult to then say, oh, but by the way, you need to exercise self-examination and discipline and of the long arc kind of formation from here on out. It's like, then why didn't you say that at the beginning? You know, and that's a problem. Like churches that market themselves that way are also facing. You know, that, and it may account for, you know, we're in Southern California, which is the experiment central for the megachurch movement. And, you know, we have the Crystal Cathedral down here, Satellite Church, we have a bunch of them. And you know, they're facing this challenge too, is that beyond that kind of conversion and recruitment, like how do we get people to stick around for the arduousness and the sometimes boredom of long-term formation? And it's a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thing to remember about all this gets back to the remnant idea is that entertainment marketing-oriented spirituality isn't working. You know, we're people are not contented. There's depression is at a very high rate. Suicides are up. So, what is the answer? Is the life of Christ that people are drawn into? And I think we have to stop assessing what we're doing with youth by how many we are able to gather in a room on a Wednesday night and start by the same fruits. Are we producing people who are going to be healthier and can grow into spiritual maturity? And sometimes just that, I think it just takes some persistence in that, you know, to establish that. So.
Now, Bishop Scarlett, you gave another talk at the retreat about a gifts-based approach to mission, and I thought that was very interesting. I think one of the, I mean, when you're in a parish long enough, you do get to know the people, and sometimes those gifts just sort of rise to the top. But what are some ways that a priest can identify the gifts of those parishioners who make up the remnant of a parish?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I'd start just by sort of challenging some of the assumptions I've certainly seen in the church that, you know, that, you know, a priest is a priest is a priest, and you're going to be this, you go out to a church, it's like every church, you know, do these things. And the truth is that not all priests are the same in their gift sets, and not all congregations are the same in their gift sets. Not all mission settings are the same. That is, the approach to even remnant formation that will work at, that doesn't really resonate. So you have to assess a lot of things. And so I think it's part of the overall remnant approach that as you draw people into a deeper life of prayer, you begin to ask a secondary question, well, who are you? What is your temperament? What are your gifts? What do you feel called to do? And part of that is caught up in the idea that, well, there's a certain assumption that informs this gift-based thing. That, okay, so we say, well, what is God calling our church to do? That's a reasonable question to ask. I don't know if people ask it, but, and so, well, how would you determine that? Well, it would seem logically that you would then assess, well, what are the gifts that he has placed in this church? And as we assess and understand what are our gifts and what are the individual Christians called to do in this place, we'll begin to get some kind of sense of how we'd move forward in it. And this would be different than, say, the vestry gets together and says, we got to have a program to do this. So let's recruit four people. And okay, who wants to do this? And then the people who are like the least emotionally mature and feel responsible for everything, I'll do it. They're already doing five things. Now they're going to do a sixth. And you got this unhealthy dynamic. So I think the first thing is, as you draw people into a life of prayer and a little bit more self-reflection, there are various, you know, tools you can use for that. Some of it's just self-assessment. There's spiritual gifts inventories. We use this Wagner modified house inventory. It's not the end all and be all of everything, but if people take it with reasonable self, you know, knowledge, they can figure out some things about themselves. There's another tool we use. I say this a little bit of caution, and I'll make some comments, things like the Enneagram. The reason the caution there is that's its whole industry now. There's all kinds of weird spirituality that goes around that. We're not really signing into all that. At a core, though, it deals with a personality type that's associated with a deadly sin and a virtue that provides a sense of, okay, who am I? It will tell you something. Oh, okay. And here's what I'm like if I'm functioning in a more healthy way. And here's what I'm like if I'm really kind of, you know, anxiously functioning. And so so the spiritual gifts, there's two things here. What are my gifts? And then how am I functioning and using those gifts, which is kind of a 1 Corinthians 13 thing. If I do all these great things and don't have the motive of agape. So it's self-assessment beginning. And then a significant part of this too, because the church values giftedness, is that as you develop people's life of prayer and their spiritual gifts and their self-awareness, you want to develop their ability to say yes to what they're called to do and no to what they're not called to do. And that's an important thing about assessing gifts. That for example, you know, a church, we just talked about youth ministry. Well, we need to do youth ministry. Who's going to do that? Well, we survey the gifts. We don't have anybody here to do youth ministry, you know. So what do we do? Well, we're going to pray and fast for a while. We're going to ask God to send those gifts. We can still, again, get to know the youth to come in and take an interest, but we're not, you know, we're going to, so that's assessing by spiritual gifts inventory. I would say a growing maturity in one's life for prayer that begins to grow into self-awareness of who one is, not just how one reacts to the anxiety around oneself to be drawn into busy activity, but who am I, articulated out by some tools like Aspergio Gifts Inventory, some personality tests, and then an assessment of what am I called to do. And as individual Christians in the church begin to think about that, you begin to have ministry development. And just St. Matthew's, for example, we've been doing this for 8 years, and some things have sort of bubbled out of that. You know, our men's group has resurfaced. We had recently our women's group was called St. Anne's Daughters. Just a group of women who've been in a more reflective spiritual life for a while, sort of got together and developed this renewed women's ministry in a much more healthy way, with a collaborative way, with many women involved, and it's working really, really well. So to some degree, the gift-based ministry naturally flows out of the cultivation of a life for prayer and an encouragement for self-reflection and gift assessment. What are you called to do? When people are free from the anxiety of what you need them to do or want them to do, and drawn into what do I really feel like God is calling me to do, they start wanting to do things. And that's where real ministry, I think, develops.
I think that as we, I've seen that. And I think an undervalued part of that whole process is, as the kind of rising level of the communal maturity, kind of increases, right? Like as the maturity of communities increase, that really helps the identification of gifts. It's always possible, and I would say likely, that we lie to ourselves with the spiritual gifts inventories and things like that, which don't correct for those kind of impulses. But it is helpful when you're like cultivating like multiple people in a community. And as people are, regularly practicing self-examination, confession, direction, cultivating spiritual friendships with each other, it creates this dimension of communication between members of a parish where, someone says, I think I'm gifted to be a teacher, and everyone's like, probably not, I know you want that. I know you saw that movie and it was great, but like that may be not right. Or they'll say, let's give it a shot. And then in, a couple of, they'll teach a 2-session class and we'll say, no, that's probably not for you. And, and I think that it gives a language for, and also a space for giving those kind of communications, or saying, you tend to just volunteer almost without thinking about it. Have you ever thought about maybe that's more like it's hard for you to leave something on the table rather than to pick that up? Like, or to another person, it seems like, you kind of don't pour in here. And this might, you're always praying for an opportunity to, develop your gifts, and yet you never volunteer for anything. Maybe it's time, and those kind of what would otherwise be characterized as like with a guest, awkward comments become more possible when we're all kind of communicating a little bit more about how we're praying, how we're living the life, how we're doing this thing. And it becomes proficiency, I think, a pursuit of proficiency as a community produces a lot of open doors to conversation that would otherwise be seen as like, that's a little iffy, or maybe I shouldn't say that to that person. It becomes more possible to do that.
And Father Hayden, I think, touched on an essential aspect of this, that this remnant framework cultivates the framework of ministry rooted in spiritual direction. So people aren't developing in isolation, they're developing the spiritual conversations. We're talking with about their gifts, and there'll be accountability, and encourages spiritual friendships where there's input, where people can say, I don't think you should do that. And sometimes people need that to be freed from their own interior impulse to always be doing things, freed to say no and say yes. So I think that's really, really important.
As we kind of bring this plane to land a little bit in this conversation, which has been so helpful and very good, perhaps we could think a little bit about what a successful mission looks like. I mean, for so many people, I think in particular in some of our churches, successful means numbers. It means church achieves a certain social status. It could mean political action, or a whole host of other goals that really don't comport at all with our mission as the church. So what does a successful parish really mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. I you know, we've used the word to describe what we want to cultivate it, or the title sort of mission community. And what I think we talk about forming a community in this life of prayer, you're really talking about the organic reality of the thing. So, for example, let's say you have a very small group of people who are willing to come along and really cultivate a communal life by rule, you know, and they develop a sense of personal growth, of communal growth. It could be half a dozen people. Maybe they find a social manifestation of that where they can invite people into it, and they find they're really doing, you know, they're sharing their life in some way. So to me, anytime you have the cultivation, it's an organic. This is assessed organically. You cultivate this life of Christ in the Spirit. It bears the fruit of people reaching out and offering that life to others. And so, if it's six people affecting two or three or four more, you've got a mission that's successful. And I think it's more in terms of its organic fruit. And that's, I think, one of the geniuses of the remnant concept, that it is not numerical. You can do this. And I think sometimes actually I have to push back against this because we're so caught up in, okay, we got to get church, got to get priests, got to do this. We certainly want some of these established things, but let's start with a group of people who just pray together and then assess their gifts and begin to think how they can reach out, because guess what? They're hurting people all over the place you can be present for. And then I think one of the key things to this is, we didn't touch on, you know, we touched on retreat, is the hospitality spaces, because if we have a community living a life of prayer, that should manifest itself some way in a social life that's attractive. You know, Acts 2, they, you know, breaking bread from house to house, they share their meals with joy. Well, if we have a life together, we should enjoy that. And that communal social space, we can invite people into it. And evangelism will often be from the social space to the personal relationship to some introduction to prayer, to community, and ultimately that's the way it goes. But it starts with the relationship thing. So I would just say we'd evaluate this much more in terms of just the organic thing that's developing. And then as that continues to grow, all the other things will come, rather than thinking about what we need a church to be and being, you know, anxious that we can't quite get it yet. And I just say on that, I know I had thought, in our mission retreat, you know, one of the most encouraging presentations by this church, a guy had gone, you know, I don't want to mention names on here, but it's they'd gone, you know, to the small church with 15 members. He talked about what he did to cultivate their life, their outreach, to connect with things in the community, to begin to generate things, you know. And so the difference there is between, I've seen people who have a, you know, a 10 or 15 member church who sit around and complain, no one comes, can't do this, can't do that. And yet here is somebody creating an organic reality that the group that grows and shares. So it's more about the organic reality rooted in the personal experience of the missionary, in his experience with Christ, his life for prayer, shared with the remnant group he calls in to follow him in that, cultivated in social and outreach spaces that have an impact. And if that's going on, I think you have a success, or at least effectiveness.
I think it's in the appendix of Pastoral Theology where Thornton basically says the finances and all that other stuff, if that's your first concern, you put the cart before the horse. If the parish doesn't want exactly what you're talking about, this kind of organic connection, common pursuit of prayer, all those kind of things, it doesn't really matter. I mean, all that other stuff is just kind of window dressing that doesn't, in fact, papers over some of what the church really should be doing.
Well, and also the other thing about that is that when you're all about the money, we need money, and then people, oh, okay, I guess I'll give. But if you cultivate a vibrant spiritual life that actually changes people's life, they're going to give you the money before you ask for it. This is great. Let's do more of this. Let's build something here, because people are excited about giving to things that have an impact. and that have changed them. But if you just have a little club trying to sustain, you're extracting money. So it's like that seek first the kingdom of God, his righteousness, these things will be added. My experience is if you focus on those, the other things tend to come along.
That's right. And well, probably, I mean, Thornton was writing that in a time where I think he at least had more nominal Christianity just because it was so culturally embedded. At a certain point, that's going to be impossible for a lot of our churches. So survival really depends on building exactly what you're talking about, a successful parish that's healthy, not on the books financially, not because it has however many number of people, but because it really is pursuing the things it should be pursuing. Did you have something? Okay, sorry. One final question. We have some Patreon supporters. They're members of what we call the Communion of Patreon Saints. In missionary outreach, how important is Anglican identity, specifically Anglican Catholic teachings? And this is especially true in a world where there's a plurality of Anglicanisms. But also in a world that, I mean, you know, I tell people, oh, I'm Anglican, and they say, what's that? You know?
Yeah. This is a really important question because I think in the essence of it, it's really important in the details of leading by talking about liturgy or some creedal thing. You know, in the first instance, not so much. Let me explain what I mean by that. I actually think Thornton suggests that the Anglican identity is manifested most clearly in what might be called the parochial Benedictine community. That Thornton's thesis is that the Church of England in the Reformation brought Benedictine rule into parish life with the Book of Common Prayer, the daily offices, Mass, daily office, and the implication of personal prayer, and that sense of in a Benedictine community and in an Anglican ethos, the modality of hospitality. There's a book called Celtic Mission and Roman Mission, where the guy points out how the Celts did a different kind of mission based on hospitality. The Romans built a structure and draw people in the structure that the Celts monastery planted and practiced hospitality. So the essence of our identity to create a community, a Benedictine parochial community that lives a life of prayer, that creates hospitality spaces that where they share their life and invite people into it, and then are involved in directive relationships where they're drawing people into the life of prayer. It seems to me that that's absolutely essential as the essence of identity. But so we're talking about the essence. I actually think that the Anglo-Catholic tradition has a tremendous amount to offer in mission now, but we don't lead with that. We often lead with, I think, things that are not not really the essence, which, and Thornton would say this too, in sense of, you know, the second generation, you have the Oxford movement, the Tractarians, we're going to get liturgy just the right way, and you got to come and do it like this. And people are like, well, let's draw them into the life of prayer. Let's draw them into liturgy as a way to commune with Christ. And then they're happy. People come that direction. They love the fullness of it. They get what it means. But you have to start with the essential of the experience and then get to the details. And our problem has been we started with the details, you know, like if you look on a, you know, typical church website, it's here's what we believe, you know, a creed, you know, 5 pages long. And that's a great statement, but it's just not the answer to a question anyone's asking. They're saying, my life hurts. How can you help me? Now, if you can, and so if we follow the kind of logic, if this creedal statement and your devotion has produced a person who can reach out to them and say, hey, come, let's talk about your life. Let's pray together a little bit. And then they'll come along pretty soon. You know, that could be someone who ends up, you know, saying amen to all that and being fully in. But we have to start with the essence of it, not these details. And so I think Anglican is in its essence as a communal community of prayer practicing hospitality and concern with, as Thornton would say, the ethos of the family, not the barracks, is of the essence of mission for us.
Yeah, that's helpful. Go ahead, Father Hayden.
I might just add, if I may, I think that we're at our heart an anti-consumerism, really an antidote to a kind of consumerist mindset. When I think we practice it in the fullness, is that we're not an aesthetic. I think the Anglo-Catholic ethos is not just another taste of Christianity. It's not another item on the buffet. It really is a sort of an integrity. It has a life to be lived there. And sure, there are things that are distinctly aesthetic and beautiful about it, but like Thornton points out, the aesthetics of it, the outward trappings of it, are really they're downstream from the ascetical, right? It has that dimension to it, which a lot of spiritualities now don't. A lot of even sort of Christian offerings lack that dimension of things, and really you have to go ancient to find it. That ascesis, right? Coaching in discipline unto holiness and life everlasting. That is a significant dimension, and that's really where I see a lot of people kind of flounder, is in terms of kind of conversion and the initiation. Sure, there's a lot out there, but in terms of and then there's a vision of holiness and beatitude. But then there's this the sort of the ladder of perfection, but not for necessarily a monastic. Like, what does a sort of a plausible path to holiness look like for a person who is working a job, raising a family, and all of that? I think the Anglican way has always held together the glory of clergy and laity and the monastic and the secular. It has always held together the glory of the individual and the community, of the liturgical and the extemporaneous. And it's always sought to hold these things in together. And I think now more than ever, we need that kind of that tension space that the ascetical provides for us of, yeah, how can you be where you're at and yet be a saint in the making? And I think we have an answer to that, a real way you can live the rest of your life. And I think that's maybe that's an answer that I think a lot of people are really seeking.
And one thing to sort of add on to that is that there's a lot of talk about rule of life in evangelical circles, but it tends to be the individual rule you choose for yourself. And I think what Anglican Mass has to offer is drawing people into a communal experience of rule that has individual dimensions. And I think it's a real strength of our tradition that we really can tolerate a range of personalities and types, that the different kind of person can fit well with us. There's that sort of space for someone to be who they are, but also a community they can actually connect with and participate in. So these are all strengths of our tradition that answer problems. We have to lead with these, not are you saying Mass the right way?
Right. We've all seen those church websites with the diatribes or, the sign that says 1928 prayer book, which is, it's a great prayer book, but that's not what people are looking for when they're looking for a church, at least not anymore. Well, thank you both for coming on today. This has been super interesting. And I think the retreat was a great success. I had a great time, learned a lot, was very encouraged coming out of it. Gave us a lot to think about. So what's kind of next in terms of that developing this in kind of the G3 continuing church?
Yeah, we we said at the retreat we asked those who are present to join us in this practice of praying and fasting for mission on Wednesdays. So we really think that's a big deal. We've done it as a church now for better part of a decade. It was when Bishop Wilson came from South Sudan and told us that if we wanted, to grow the church, we need to fast and pray. And in South Sudan, when they do that, they don't eat for 3 days. I think we got to respond. So we established this. I like our group that came out of that to fast and pray. And that's the beginning of sowing the seeds for a thing. We're going to continue this conversation with the meeting next year at our joint synods. and will draw more interested people in. We'd like to continue, you know, particular conversations with individual situations. We can provide some direction and guidance if you know, the bishop is okay with that, and pray for people, and also tell more and more stories about this. We also would like to focus on, church planting in a new way, in a way this sort of mission community modality. We've realized as a movement, we have to start mission by funding missionaries and identifying mission-minded priests who want to go and develop this vision in a place and supporting them. So we'd like to begin to target areas to do that. We've got some things already in the works on that, but I'd like to develop that. So fasting, praying, continuing the conversation, highlighting where it's happening, looking for new opportunities to do it, and then continually inviting people. Listen, we had a College of Bishops meeting today. I just said, this is not an exclusive thing. If you, if you're serious, about your experience of love for Christ, you're committed to your own life for prayer and growth, you want to share that with other people, come and join us in this work, and let's change. This is I think the future of Anglo-Catholic mission. I think this is what I just think it is our true essence and identity, and the more people join us with, I think we can continue to build something of a truly missionary future.
Excellent. Well, again, thank you to you both. As we close out today, one thing that we like to do is talk about one thing that we're into these days. Bishop Scarlett, what are you into?
Yeah, I just want to highlight something as a second time a peri on this, that at the end of my last time, you all had a lot of things I like to. I'm into coffee, I'm into beer and things like that. But I said I needed my Golden State Warriors to win the NBA championship and restore order to the universe. And I just want to mention that did in fact happen. And so there is that. I'm into my Oregon Ducks, who have as you can see, I'm a sports fan. I try to moderate that in my life, who have a big game against UCLA in Eugene in 2 weeks. We have some UCLA people at the parish who are interested in looking at that. So that is going on. And that were a couple of the many things I'm in culinary wise. I'm into in the last season of time, a cigar called the Godmother that is proprietary to a place I go to. That is really a great cigar.
Given your track record of success, Father Hayden and I really need you to be into the Dallas Cowboys.
Well, I'm suffering as a Raider fan this year.
He's a Raiders guy.
Oh, I know. That was, well, the thing is, they're a good team. They just don't know how to win at the end.
That was. I've had two purgatorial losses this year.
Father Hayden, what are you into these days?
Well, like you said, I'm a third generation Cowboys fan in the Butler family, and that's for a lot of my life, that's been kind of a tragic romance. And this year could be no exception. I remember being, remember the Aikman years and all that, and then the long drought that has, been subsequent. But I'm looking forward to, what we're going to do against the Eagles. As I said before, we started recording today, there's no team I love to beat more than the Philadelphia Eagles. So I'm really hoping for a win this week, and maybe we'll give some hope. We had a rough start, but we've had a good few games. So, we always say it's our year, and one year we're going to be right. So,
Father Hayden, that bodes well. That when we flew into the mission retreat, we got in late, went to just a bar to get a hamburger, and the Cowboy game was on. And they beat the Giants in the fourth quarter, so maybe this bodes well for.
I think so. It was great to be able to see a Dallas win in Dallas. I felt finally like I wasn't having to hide. Like I do out in Southern California. So. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I told you all this, but as a fellow Cowboys fan, when I found out that's where the retreat was, I looked at the schedule and saw they were playing the Washington Commanders. And so I bought two tickets. My dad's a Washington fan, so So he flew down on Friday after the conference, and we went to the game. And then I said, well, I feel real bad that you paid all this money to fly down and come to the game and only to watch your team get crushed. But, you know, I didn't feel that bad about it, to be honest, though. Sorry, Dad, if you're listening.
What a place. What a place to be.
Man, it was electric.
For a win like that, yeah.
What was great was on the plane home, there were about as many Cowboys fans as Washington fans. And every time a Washington fan would walk down the center aisle, the Cowboys fans would all, you know, chant at them. And then I realized that's probably why everybody hates us, but
they're going to hate anyway. You might as well, you know, enjoy life in the meantime, you know, can't be tied to their approval. Yeah. And then I think elsewise in my life, I'm really into, my wife and I are really into baking. And so we make bread a lot. And so this last season, we've been trying to master the tenuous art of high hydration sourdough, which is that really great crusty, you know, full of like air holes kind of bread. It is notoriously tricky, especially with the temperature fluctuations we're having right now. And, but you know, it's a lot of fun. We've had a sourdough, culture that we've grown for the last 10 years, named Zeno. It sits on our countertop. It's kind of like a pet and, helps us make good bread. And so we're working on that really like, it's like Icarus, right? You have to, if you push it too far, you know, your wings melt and you fall into the sea. And that's happened with a few of our loaves recently, but you know, we're trying to perfect the art. And it's always fun doing something that humans have been doing since there have been humans. And to know that, you know, this thing that, you know, it's only four ingredients, and really is all about technique, and that no matter how many YouTube videos you watch, some grandmother somewhere is just going to like own you every time because, you know, they've been doing it for 70 years. And I love things like that, where the time put into the practice is really significant. I think that'll preach. And, I think I'm always inspired by like, Robert Capon's book, The Supper of the Lamb. You know, on this note, you know, where, you know, that cooking and baking as a kind of contemplative, exercise, that resonates with me. So
have you ever sat with an onion for an hour?
I actually have. I led some students through that one time, during the quarantine. When we were all trying to stay sane during the lockdowns here, I did this series of short videos for my high school students called Quarantine Cooking, because a lot of them were having to cook for themselves for the first time. And so I was doing some just basic tutorials on how to not have to eat, you know, cereal for every meal if you're having to cook for yourself. And we did the exercise with the onion and getting to know the onion. And it was a fun one. It was a good experience during that otherwise kind of wild time.
That is excellent. I love it. So for me, to give myself a challenge at the beginning of each church year, I'll often say I'm going to preach on a certain proper of the day. So like 2 years ago, I preached on all the gospel readings. And then this year I've been preaching on the epistle readings. And so because we've been in the epistles and because most of our epistle readings come from St. Paul, I have rediscovered a book that I've read before a couple times and really, really enjoyed it. But it's called Becoming Human Together: The Pastoral Anthropology of St. Paul by Jerome Murphy O'Connor, who is a Roman Catholic New Testament scholar. And there are some things in it that I don't agree with, but for the most part, it is a really, I think, positive reading of St. Paul that I have just come to really love. Sort of emphasizes the humanistic elements in Paul, which I think is good. And so, yeah, it's just been fun to revisit that each week when I preach. I always look in the index to see if that text is something he addresses specifically. But yeah, it's a really good book. So The Pastoral Anthropology of St. Paul by Jerome Murphy O'Connor. Well, thank you both again for being on. It has been a pleasure talking with you all. I hope that we can have you on again sometime in the near future.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And listeners, if you like what we're doing, you can help others find us by rating and reviewing us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to continue the conversation, you can find us on social media, on Twitter or on Facebook. And you can also support us over on Patreon. You can join the Communion of Patreon Saints for just $5 a month. To close, we'll pray the collect for mission from the Book of Common Prayer. Let us pray. O God, who hast made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the whole earth, and didst send thy blessed Son to preach peace to them that are far off and to them that are nigh, grant that all men everywhere may seek after thee and find thee, bring the nations into thy fold, pour out thy Spirit upon all flesh, and hasten thy kingdom through the same thy Son, Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.